want to repeat you as decent marketing.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, he only invited Chris back, and I said, you can't, you know, they don't. So anyway, I've been trying to help educate him on that stuff.
Who's on the phone?
Michelle.
Hi, Michelle. You're the first one on.
Hi. This is Joy Wilson from the Upper Columbia Salmon Recovery Board.
Okay. Welcome.
Thank you.
Here's Mark with yesterday. We're in Strive for the first ceremonial fishery in 100 years.
How'd it go?
It went really well, as you can see from that picture. But,
wow.
But they had 127 fish and 2 trucks.
Who grabbed the fish?
ODNW. They were supposed to be there about noon. They arrived at like 4 o'clock. You know, so I had a really late time getting back.
What happened?
It just takes longer than, you know, the first time you get there, and it's, you know, bad, you know, lousy roads to drive on with those big fish trucks. So, but it was excellent. They probably caught 15 fish already out of that.
Yeah, wow.
That's but great. It was excellent.
That's really cool.
The kids had a great time.
Yeah.
That was the important thing. So.
Mm-hmm.
Were you down? You were down from the Shoshone Paiute Desert, right?
Yeah.
I remember Chad talking about how great that was.
Yeah, and the show bands came over to the Burns tribe and helped them put together the spears. So they had beautifully handmade spears, and they worked pretty well.
Yeah.
And the kids were using them. You know, a lot of times the adults made the spears and gave them to the kids. So here you go.
That's awesome.
I bet.
Yeah.
I'd say half the fish caught were caught by the youngsters.
How many fish did they catch?
They're agile.
We counted 15 that we saw that people actually picked up.
Yeah.
Did
they radio tag the last fish?
They tried to sort them out so that they're mostly male.
I'll pull those up on screen.
Okay.
I think
good photo. It's always good to have one. Here's what I caught.
Jennifer.
Okay.
Sure.
And then we'll have
How many fish do you
have? I've got Jennifer and Dan Rodden.
Okay.
So I can get this to go to my I took pictures of people just like scattered.
30.
You know, they're wandering around and trying to ensure that they can.
Sweater?
Huh?
Cotton mouth?
Excuse me.
I have some in my drawer. I brought one of those when I got here. I might want to grab some. Oh, I have these. Oh, those are pretty good.
I might have some more.
Hey, Lynn. This is Jennifer.
Hi, Jennifer.
How you doing?
I'm doing well.
Good. How's the audio? Is it seem to be working good?
Yeah, we're in the small conference room, and can you hear me fine?
Yep, I can hear you.
I'm right in front of a mic, but...
You're not talking very loud, so that's good.
Yeah, I'm using my small conference room voice.
We all should do that, too.
Hi, Lynn, it's Paul Fine.
Hi, Paul. Yeah, I see that you were on. We have... Dan, Jennifer, you, Joy, Michelle, on the phone so far.
I snuck on too, Sarah Borock from California Fish and Wildlife.
Oh, hi, Sarah.
Figured I'd listen in.
Yeah. Well, that's good because if people have any questions.
You started all this.
Yeah, you started all this.
My fault. Teresa Scott also joined the call.
Okay, hi, Teresa. Teresa Scott and Sarah Borough.
And this is Dan Rodding.
Hi, Dan.
Hello.
Hey, Mr. Gribber. How are you?
Hey, Lynn. Jen Bayer's here.
Hey, Jen.
And Michael Garrity's here at WDFW, too.
Hi, Michael.
Hey.
Hi. And it's Denny Rohr.
Denny Rohr. How are you? And who is the other person that tried?
This is Steve Schroeder.
I'm sorry, I missed two. Steve Schroeder, and who was right before?
Diane Barton from Critvic.
Diane Barton. Hi, Diane. I think someone else may have.
Yeah, I didn't bang on. This is Jeff Korth with WDFW.
Jeff Korth, all right, great. And
Jay Hesse went first.
Jay Hesse. We're going to read back names that eventually when we do introductions here, and I'll make sure I get everybody that's on the phone.
Hey, Lynn, Stacey Horton, Washington Council staff.
All right, thank you.
Good morning.
Lynn, this is Matt Boyer with Fish, Wildlife, and Parks, Montana.
Matt? Hi, Matt.
How you doing?
Good.
Then have a party and people come.
Yes.
About right. Not just a party about fish either.
That's why we always had our initial meetings in person, so we could have a party.
Yeah, oh, that's a good idea. That's Sarah Borock from California on that call to be there in case we have questions. Listen in. Yeah.
Eavesdropping.
Yep. No, that's good. Could come in handy to have you on the phone.
I'm not sure if Catherine's calling in, too, or not.
Kind of hit me today.
Okay, 133. There's a couple more people trickling in here, so we'll...
see what happens.
Wait another minute.
But early morning.
The early time we
have. I know. That's great. Laura Berg's on the phone, right? Okay. Oh, okay. All right.
Sure.
Okay. ODF&W.
I took home from
sweet. Okay. Who from ODF&W is on? Is that Tom or Tucker? Both?
This is Tom.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
We're sitting in for Greg Schumacher. I'm not sure.
We've got the four states represented here. We've got somebody from Critvic and Upper Columbia. Oh, Mark Begdevitz, hi.
Hey, Lynn, I'm here.
Good to hear your voice. It's been a while.
Yeah, I've been on other things. But back here now.
Great. John Palmer. Hi, John. All right. Well, this may be all we get into the room here.
Kind of packed out.
Yeah, kind of packed out. So let's just get started and... I'll just start by thanking everybody for either coming here to our office or calling in. This was a pretty quickly scheduled meeting. We'll do some introductions. I'll go back through. Just give a few people more time to get on the phone. But just a couple quick housekeeping things. Everyone knows where the bathrooms are here, I'm assuming. Yes. Okay. And also, this is scheduled right in between a couple of Bill Maslin's retirement parties. So if you are here, you can get over to the second party at the happy hour across the river. So it'll be great. We've got GoTo meeting up. So if anyone's on the phone and doesn't have access to GoTo meeting or can't see the screen for some reason, let us know. We're using this just to show a few of the documents, one being the draft agenda and just a few other pieces that will come up during the meeting, but also primarily is to track, since we have so many people on the phone, it'll be helpful to let us know when you have a question. So one approach would be just to interrupt whoever's talking and say, I have a question, although you might be talking over each other. So if it's something that can wait, but you just want to say something, you can send a message directly here and under the GoTo meeting side screen there, and we'll see it. And I've got Kendra Coles right next to me recording people who want to say something. Jennifer Anders, our Montana council member, is in Montana, and she's the official note taker and will help us wrap up and sum up at the end of the meeting. So thanks, Jennifer. And we do have a lot of people on the phone, so please make sure that you speak into your microphones. And if you haven't done so already, then you can silence your cell phones. Please don't put us on hold if you need to run off somewhere, because we often hear horrible hold music in the background for the whole meeting to hear. So, feel free to mute when you're not speaking. I'm gonna go through and just repeat the names of the people we think we have on the phone here. And if I'm missing someone, just let me know, and then we'll go around the room so you know who's in the room. So we've got Michelle DeHart, yeah, from Fish Passage Center. Joy Jewelson from the Upper Columbia Salmon Recovery Board. Jennifer Anders, our Montana council member. Dan Rodding from WDFW. Paul Klein, IDFG. Teresa Scott, WDFW. Sarah Barak, Cal Fish and Game. What are you? California Department of Fish and
Wildlife, but Fish and
Fish and Wildlife. Okay, thank you. Jan Baer from PNAP, Michael Garrity from WDFW, Denny Rohr representing Grant County, PD, Steve Schroeder, he's on our ISAB, Diane Barton, Critfic, right? Jeff Porth, WDFW, Jay Hesse, Nez Perce Tribe, Stacy Horton, our East Washington Council staff, Matt Boyer, Montana Fish Wildlife Parks, Carrie Berg, our Montana Fish and Wildlife staff person, Laura Berg, with
Clearing Up.
Thank you. I was thinking. Tom Rean, ODFW, Mark Bagdovitz, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and John Palmer, EPA. Did I miss anyone on the phone?
Brad Newswood, Confederated Tribes of Warm Springs.
Okay. Hi, Brad.
Warm Springs. Michael Bryan.
Anyone else?
Yes, Michael Bryan, Columbia Basin Bulletin.
Eric Van Dyke, Oregon.
Jim Winton and Maureen Purcell in Seattle are sitting in at the request of Greg, if you're...
Okay, can you say your names again?
Yeah, it's Jim Winton, W-I-N-T-O-N, and Maureen Purcell, P-U-R-C-E-L-L. It's the U.S. Geological Survey's Western Fisheries Research Center. We're the fish health team up here.
Okay, great. Anyone else? Okay, and in the room, we've got, introduce yourself.
Kendra Cole from Council Staff.
And Lynn Polensky, Council Staff.
Mary Lee Socia, EPA.
Bob Austin, Upper Snake River Tribes.
Scott Donahue, Bonneville Power.
Eric Merrill, Coordinator for the Independent Science Review Groups.
Tom Iverson with Yakima Nation Fisheries.
John Harrison with the Public Affairs Staff on the Council.
Tony Grover, Director of Fish and Wildlife for the Power Council.
Great. I think that's it. Anyone else we're missing? Okay. All right. So obviously we have a pretty diverse group of people here in the room and on the phone. Lots of expertise. We're not the experts, but you all are. Dam operations, hydro system, fish management policy, tributary habitat. We've got fish health people, folks that collect and house environmental data, communications people, lots. So there's a lot of interest. There's a lot of smart people in this room and on the call. I just want to say, I think no matter what, you know, each particular person's area of expertise or focus might be, I think, you know, we all have a common goal or at least a common interest in improving habitat and pathways to have our fish spawning, back spawning in our river. And that doesn't mean just sockeye. It means sockeye, sturgeon, lamprey, other salmonid species. So I think that's the goal for everyone here. We have an interest in fish, so. I guess it'll be important throughout the meeting to just keep in mind that not everybody will be familiar with who you are or what you do or what support you provide to the basin, the fish managers. So when you do have something that you want to say or a question, just please repeat your name and your affiliation so we know who you are. That would be great. So let's scroll. No, don't scroll yet. I'm going to talk a little bit about the background for the meeting, and then we can go back and check in on the agenda. I guess the impetus for this meeting was really related to last year's unprecedented environmental conditions that we had in June and July that led to very high sockeye mortality and above normal sturgeon mortality. And there were some steps to getting here today between the summer and here we are in late spring. And I guess there's probably no doubt that there's a lot of other people in the basin that were having really similar discussions and assessments and head scratching for what happened and really just not wanting to see that scenario happen again anytime soon. And while there are a lot of bright minds that were working on getting the fish past each dam, I don't think any of us were really prepared for what happened with the fish in between. And most notably, I think we didn't have the ability to, one, quantify the mortality for sturgeon that died in the main stem, or determine the exact cause for the mortality for the sockeye and the sturgeon. And we didn't really have any infrastructure in place to monitor and assess post-mortem. So after the fish died, we realized they were dying in the reservoirs or wherever they were. We didn't have the ability to go out, boots on the ground, and collect tissue samples and understand what the causality was for the mortality. So that just sort of sums up, I think, the interest we had in this and how we got here. But I want to step back and how we got to this meeting specifically. And for those of you who are not familiar with the Regional Coordination Forum, this is a group. Hi, Rock. Rock Peters just walked in. Hi. Welcome. We're just going through a little background of how we got here. So I want to step back and say, after the sort of brutal conditions in the summer, you know, everybody was sort of swirling around and talking about what happened, looking at retrospectively what happened, what we could have done. There were discussions among managers that, at least in our regional coordination forum, about the need for additional monitoring data, maybe in the reservoirs. There's been a lot of talk about understanding the temperature differentials, the ladders at the dam. There was talk about what do we do with the sturgeon we found or we didn't find in the reservoirs that were dead. Did we just see the tip of the iceberg? Were there more? And there were a lot of questions sort of surrounding the summer, post-summer. So in August, let's pull up the next page on here on the GoToMeeting. I just want to kind of walk through the history here. So in August, we had a few folks come in and talk to the council about the extreme heat and drought conditions. So we had Fish and Wildlife agencies and the Corps came and gave a little briefing. So we started to really talk about the challenges and responses, sort of the real time, what did you do, what happened, what did you see, what real time harvest regulations, operations changes did you make, you know, at this time, it was like last month. So we kind of heard that real time in front of the council. Then we heard more at the October council meeting on climate change impacts to the Columbia River systems. And then we heard from ODFW and the other sturgeon managers about the challenges and the status of Columbia River, lower Columbia White River sturgeon, and what they faced during the summer conditions as well. Right after that council meeting, or maybe it was right before, I can't quite remember the dates, but in the Regional Coordination Forum, which is really made up of the people that are paid through Bonneville as regional coordinators for the Fish and Wildlife Program. So it's a representative from each of the four states. We have representatives from each of the tribes. Those are the people who are paid to coordinate with the program. And then we have some others that in the past were part of CUBFA that got money to coordinate. They still show up. We've got a NOAA representative, Fish and Wildlife Service. So those are the core regional coordinators. We have Bonneville at the table all the time. And we usually have some participation with the Salmon Recovery Funding Board or Salmon Recovery Boards around the region as well, because they have a scope that encompasses many sub-basins generally. So, and they do a lot of coordination with our fish and wildlife managers. We also have a representative that usually shows up from StreamNet and PNAMP because they have they provide direct support to fish and wildlife managers for data and monitoring. So that's our core group. And so in this regional coordination forum in October, we kept having these conversations about the summer and maybe, you know, what can we do about it? How do we want to see things? Well, I guess there was some thought that we may have this type of summer again in the not-too-distant future. So what are our lessons learned? So that's when the conversation got started, recounting those conditions, talking about fish mortalities and the need to have some specific additional environmental data like temperature and oxygen, dissolved oxygen in particular. So that led to a suggestion by someone on the forum, on the regional coordination forum, to look at the emergency or the early warning system of the Klamath as a model. So what can we learn from them? So the next meeting, and I'm skipping over several presentations that were given to the council in winter and early spring related to this. But in May, at the last regional coordination forum meeting, we actually invited the co-coordinators of the Klamath fish health team to come up and give a presentation on their very regimented, very dialed-in program of an early warning system to prevent or minimize fish kills in the Klamath. And part of that, there's like, I always think of it in two parts. There's sort of the data collection, the monitoring, the assessment, the technical end that leads to making a decision for or taking an action to prevent or minimize fish kill. But they also have a process for when they find dead fish in large quantities, how they deal with that. So to me, those are sort of two different things. In my mind, I always thought, well, it was probably a lot easier to agree on how to go out and take fish tissue samples than it was to come into agreement on an action to take to prevent fish from dying in the Klamath. So we heard, I don't know, a good 40-minute presentation that was very enlightening, and there were a lot of good questions and a lot of discussion around it. And I think when people left from this meeting, there was a common thought that this isn't something that we're looking to duplicate in the Columbia. It's a very, very different system. But it was about and I'll quote Tom, because I think Tom characterized it, Tom Iverson characterized this really well. It's really not about duplicating it. It's about the concepts that they have and looking at what potential improvements we can make to coordination, whether it's data, resources, decision-making, whatever, boots on the ground, sharing equipment, whatever that means, we could take a look at their model and see where we could incorporate some of those thoughts. So, yes, Tom.
Since you used my name, I think I get 30 seconds.
Sure.
The concept, this may just be a transparency question. There are discussions about this occurring in other forums that the regional coordinators may or may not be involved in. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's what today could really help us with, is understanding what the conversations in other forums are and just bringing some transparency to the rest of, just so everybody sort of understands all the moving parts in this.
Yeah. No, I think that's a really good point. And I know there's other conversations that are happening, and they're all sort of spinning around, circling, bumping into each other every once in a while in different forums. And I think that's what I hope to get out of this meeting today, is like, at least hear what other folks are thinking, how you're approaching this next summer, that type of thing. So that's really how we got to where we are today. At the May 12th meeting, after we listened to the Klamath folks and after we had our meeting and came back around to next steps, people were generally interested in having a follow-up discussion, as we are today, on just initial sort of broad regional discussion on exploring improvements in communication around these kind of events or early warning systems. It was recognized in the group for the different people that there's a lot of acknowledgement that there's a lot of folks doing things already. There's a lot of things being done. There's a lot of thought behind all this. In some cases it's sort of siloed up. In some cases it's bleeding over into, the next door neighbor's silo. But this was just an opportunity to all be in the same room and talk about it together. But there was also an acknowledgement that whatever we do, there's a definite need to at least connect with and coordinate with the PISH Passage Advisory Committee, FPOM, FPAC, the technical management team, the systems configuration team, all the folks that are sort of doing the at-dam passage work on the federal dams. So there's a lot of common themes that I've talked to a lot of you on the phone. There are a lot of common themes, and there were some other interesting perspectives along the way. So I do appreciate all your interest and attention and actually being here today. And the conversation really does fit in well with the Council's program, especially in terms of adaptive management. It so relates to our program in the areas of ecosystem function, cold water refuges, artificial production. We're paying a lot of money to produce fish in the basin and the program, up to, just a rough number is about, $88 million a year in just artificial production. And that's not to... That's not to mention all the other parts that support that. And climate change impacts. So, and we, at the council members are interested in this, and the council wanted to offer, a place where we could have this meeting at least facilitate an open forum discussion. And I want to move right to the kind of meeting objectives and the agenda, but I also want to invite Tony or Jennifer to add anything that you feel like I might have missed or that you want to emphasize.
This is Tony Grover. I won't be shy about jumping in when I want to, but I think it would be a good idea to move on to the meeting objectives and
right.
Make sure if people think we have other objectives, that we should know about that.
All right. Thanks. Jennifer, anything else? Ed?
I'm ready to move along. Great.
All right. All right. Great. So I think, do I have the meeting objectives up there? Darn it, I don't. I can read them. But if you can, you go to box really quick. Mm-hmm. I'm gonna pull them up on the screen here.
There's Lynn's pocket.
Yeah. And you're gonna scroll down to, keep scrolling. Right there. If you can you blow that up a little bit? Okay. So these are the ones that I came up with sort of in coordination with a lot of people through a lot of phone calls. One is to explore opportunities to improve coordination of data and data sharing regarding fish passage and adverse environmental conditions in an effort to respond quickly and efficiently to prevent or minimize fish mortality. And the next one is explore opportunities to improve communication and coordination of resources to assess the cause and scope of fish mortality in the event of a fish kill. So that kind of goes back to my thought of sort of two different parts to this. There's the prevention part, and then there's the reaction or response part. Does anybody have any thoughts about those objectives? Scroll down a little bit and get rid of that. Put some spaces on there.
So Lynn, I would just add that response objective, and I'm just thinking the way you're thinking, and just correct me, is about how we learn from adaptive management perspective so that the next time if we look at the postmortem and we try and understand why the fish are dying, that we get smarter so that the next time something we can be even that much better prepared the next time for when it would happen. I mean, that's what you're thinking, right?
That's what I'm thinking, and I would probably defer to the fish managers like Paul Klein or Dan to add anything to that more specific.
Yeah, this is Paul. That sounds fair.
Okay. Anyone else? Eric, Merrill?
Similar to, I'm wondering if there's things it says to respond quickly. Things that we'll know in advance that we can maybe not have to respond as quickly, but we can have a plan for if there's certain conditions start to arise, that there's a basic management things that we've thought about.
Yeah, I think that's in part what the first objective is. That's what I would probably term as the prevention or the data assessment that leads you to a particular action to prevent.
That's good.
Just a thought. This sort of takes me back to.
Rock, can you introduce yourself?
I'm sorry. This is Rock Peters with the Corps. Yes, I came in late. I apologize. Back in the 90s, we had a lot of issues down on the road. One year, we lost 80% of the fish, spring chinook. And recognized there, while that is a very different system than the Columbia, the first part is so you hit a certain temperature of an environmental trigger, and then there's a second set. And you can do this either passively or more aggressively, action-oriented. And that would be once you hit that certain trigger, that sets you into motion to say, let's go out and look. And I don't know whether that would be a main stem look or a hatchery look or what it may be. You may want to think across the processes. So they're, instead of just being passive and say, oh, yeah, we found 30 dead fish, it's saying, okay, now this, we're starting to see an action occur as a result of this temperature. So mm-hmm. it's not necessarily just passively letting it occur. And then usually it's too late.
Tony Grover here. I want to support what Rock just said. And I'm recalling the presentation from the experts in the Klamath that they had the green, yellow, orange, red indicator conditions. And there were certain criteria that told you when you were in each color. And, of course, when you're in green, everything's fine. And when you're in red, you're in a world of trouble. And there's a lot of stuff in between. And doing just what Rock said is if what could come out of this effort would be a generally agreed upon who calls who, sort of an incident command structure kind of network where
We know who's going to receive phone calls and what they're going to do when they get those phone calls, and under what conditions should they get those phone calls. And I think that would be a huge accomplishment of this group. And even though, as you said, Lynn, this process is not intended to displace any existing fish passage-oriented decision-making bodies like TMT and SCT and things like that, it's certainly meant to supplement and make more efficient the efforts of other people in the basin. And we don't know if there's any magic rabbits that can be pulled out of the hat, because we have a very different system than the Klamath, but at least if we have early information, we can start thinking sooner and maybe even be prepared.
Yeah, thanks, Tony. I had Kendra pull up the KFAT website. Some of you may have seen this or looked into it.
Sarah Borough, I am the coordinator with KFAT, and I was just going to say, if you could pull that up. What we kind of did, our process when we started this, was each entity kind of started as your worst-case scenario and started writing down points of, you know, how we would manage this, what could be done, what can't be done, when would we start looking, and then we started comparing and finding similarities and ways we could work together. So that was kind of how we started that process. And then, you know, found our benchmarks, okay, you know, when the temperature reaches this in the Klamath, then we need to do this. Then we need to ask for more water if it's looking like this and the fish are doing this. So that's kind of where we started in the Klamath system.
Yeah, my understanding is that, and we talked about this a little bit more in detail in the regional coordination group, are the, like, environmental triggers, like you said. And I heard that particular word from many people in conversations, like, what are the triggers? Let's identify them, where they occur, what dams, where in the tributaries. But then also a lot of people said we need to get, you know, all the tools in our toolbox on the table. So we can sort of start pairing those up. What are the triggers and what are the tools?
Mm-hmm.
And they're going to be different tools in different places and different triggers in different places, my understanding. Yeah.
Hey, Lynn, this is Ms. Perstrike.
Hi. Go ahead.
Yeah, thanks. I was going to say that the two objectives that you had listed on there, I mean, they mainly had to do with communication and coordination. And I think it's I am involved in some of the forums that Tony has mentioned, you know, the TMTs and the FPOMs to a degree and all that kind of stuff. And know that there's a lot of information being collected, and there's a lot, you know, as the fish migration seasons progress, there's quite a bit that's actually known and is available. It's put out there. So I think perhaps the start of this whole thing would be to go ahead, you know, as the objectives stated, and look at the communication and coordination. And see, for example, if there's a better way to have this stuff more accessible, rather than creating something else, you know. The command center thing, I think, sounds okay for a crisis situation, but it's not, unfortunately, the reality is I don't think it's that simple, because it's just such a big system. When you talk about migration to the Columbia and Snake, there's so many moving parts and factors, and in terms of actions, there are pros and cons of almost every action that you look to do. So I think it's a good stroke for everybody to, like, as things progress, to be on the same page as far as what's happening, you know, and fish condition and all that kind of stuff. But in terms of strike force kind of thing on what to do about all of that, if there is anything to do about all of that, it's kind of a different matter. Thanks.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thanks, Dave. So the meeting objectives are, they're sort of, I mean, they're general. They're intended to be general, so we could sort of move forward with trying to get to that understanding, as Dave mentioned, like what exists out there, what processes exist, what are people thinking about moving forward for next summer? Because I know there's been a lot of thought behind this. I know people are doing things. I know there's, you know, more and new data available out there. So maybe we just move right into that next agenda item, but just I just want to make one more note that what I didn't want this meeting to be, and I don't think it's probably an appropriate time, although it's really easy to do. The easy part is for everyone just to jump right into the details of specific dam operations or very specific tweaks to the system. I think we're still at the sort of higher level about how we communicate and what this is and if people have the appetite to coordinate a little bit more. But I do want to acknowledge that there are some really smart people out there thinking about this. They get paid to do that, and these groups that we mentioned. So let's move on. I guess at this point, this is where, if people are fine with it, we jump into hearing from some key folks about what they're doing, what they're thinking moving into the next year, and how they feel about this process in general. So I guess I could start. I have nobody from FPAC on the phone, right? I don't think so. Fish Passage.
Well, you've got some participants in FPAC.
Yeah.
A chair. I didn't hear
chair
or... Yeah.
Right. Okay. So I did have a communication with Tom Lors, and he couldn't make it, and I don't think Paul LeBaron could be on here too, but he did send me some information to convey to the group. So I think that's at the bottom. And I'll just let's quickly talk about it. FPAC is Fish Passage Advisory Committee that's got that works on their focus or their scope is from Bonneville up to the trapping facilities, the Lower Granite Dam, and they focus just on Fish Passage. And they're doing some work, and he's committed to, just actually conveying that they're doing some different things, reviewing things more intensely on a weekly basis. But there's a list of five some metrics and things that they'll be looking at. One is temperatures at several river locations. The Fish Passage Center added a site to their webpage for that data. The Corps added some additional locations, Lower Granite, to get ladder temperature data posted on the web. There's as temperatures approach 68 degrees at the Lower Granite Tail Race, they'll begin to manage more manage discharges to help keep the tail race under 68 degrees. So there's some very specific things they're doing. At the very end, I wanted to point out that the recommendation, they're going to recommend to the Corps, NOAA, that they develop a subcommittee or a subcommittee be developed to be activated in the event of adult passage problem that can meet regularly to review passage and temperature information. So their hope is to have one location, one group making these technical recommendations and not multiple groups where information can get misunderstood. So I want to convey this. I have it. This was on an email. So I'm just doing that for Tom. Anybody has any comments on this? It's pretty specific, pretty detailed. And
hi.
Tony?
Two observations. I strongly endorse that whatever information, communication, and coordination effort comes out of this discussion should feed into supporting efforts like that last paragraph on the page right now. So they make an excellent point. If you have two leaders, you don't have any leaders. So you really need one place where decisions are made. But people need to know what's going on in that group in case they have critical information that might not be considered by that group. They need to know to get it to that group. And the best way that can happen is in an organized fashion.
Yeah.
But then there's a giant piece of the puzzle that's missing, and we don't have any similar system for sturgeon or non-salmon steelhead. We were sort of at the earliest stages of developing some sort of a monitoring system for non-anadromous fish.
Exactly.
So,
and I'll channel for Dave Sattler, lamprey.
And lamprey.
we really don't know what anything happens to lamprey. We really have information on sockeye and sturgeon.
Yeah.
And the sturgeon, I'll wait till we get there. No, I won't. No, you brought it up. So I'll just say the coordination for sturgeon sort of defaulted to Olaf Langness at WDFW, who everybody just sent him data, and it was great because he's a great communicator. He sent out weekly reports, but that wasn't planned. Mm-hmm. That wasn't planned at all. So carcasses found, pictures, photos, they all came in, but it all came in late. Like carcasses were way too decomposed to do anything with. The reservoirs are huge. It was hard to find the sturgeon. We didn't know which, if any, floated versus sunk, and we just didn't have those numbers. So, yeah, a lot of things were ad hoc. A lot of things were organized, but again, it was this kind of siloed effort.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I guess I just want to add a couple of things.
Yeah.
So first, I think this is, you know, some summary of some lessons learned. So kudos to the Fish Passage Center for trying to add some more temperature data that's going to be available to everyone.
Yep.
So that's real helpful. Someone earlier talked about some triggers. Bullet 1A talks about 68 at the Granite Tail Race. So, and then, you know, getting down, you know, the last bullet is the subcommittee one that I want to highlight. So I guess what I wanted to highlight is that Fish Passage Advisory Committee clearly was thinking along the same lines that we were about being more proactive about this. And I think this is a great step forward.
Excellent. Thanks, Dan. Okay. Unless there's something else anyone wants to bring up right now, hearing from IDFG on snake river sockeye would be good. And Paul, I think you're going to talk about that.
Sure, Lynn. Can you all hear me okay?
Yes.
Yes.
All right. Well, I don't know quite where to start, except I think we're all familiar with what we experienced in FY15. I think we had about 4,500 estimated sockeye, snake river sockeye, over Bonneville Dam in that year, last year. And I think, if I remember the most round percentage number, I think about 1% of those made it to Lower Granite. So that was quite dismal with respect to what happened. Just where that mortality occurred, just for everyone's benefit, the majority of it occurred downstream of McNary and certainly Ice Harbor. So about 80 to 90% of that occurred even before the Snake River. So when we're talking about actions in the Snake River to, you know, prevent something like what happened last year, mm-hmm. it's kind of a difficult catch-22 because most of the mortality happened before the Snake River. So that's important for everyone to understand. And Rock or anyone else that is in the room, please chime in to, you know, augment what I say or to correct something that I say that's wrong. So a couple of things that happened this year. There was a lot of interest in producing retrospective reports on 2015, and that took place. And one of the biggest was by NOAA Fisheries. And Lynn and Tony, you'll recall Richie Graves just a meeting or two ago came to the council and presented their 2015 passage report that included recommendations.
Yep.
And you've got that. And that's a very good report. It's a very thorough analysis of where the mortality occurred and everything that I just talked about. And there were recommendations to develop a more fleshed out emergency strategy or plan for Snake River sockeye salmon that included triggers for when emergency actions would be initiated. So that we have. That's a piece of information that will help us manage into the future. Also, a couple of other things that are going on. I believe FPOM developed a document that was looking into feasibility of developing temporary emergency holding and transportation protocols for Ice Harbor Dam. Last year, we did talk about going down a little further in the system. We visited the facility. It's not ideal right now, and I think that is what initiated or prompted this recommendation by FPOM, is to start looking into what we can do at Ice Harbor to develop its facility so that it could potentially be used. However, we run into water temperature issues at Ice Harbor the further we get downstream as well, which I can talk about in just a second here. But keep that in mind, interest in Ice Harbor, moving further downstream to initiate holding and traffic haul. On the Bonneville end of things, we are working with Bonneville right now to include a new work element in our sockeye program statement of work that would be to produce an emergency trap and haul document that is run through the program's technical oversight committee. That's the partner group that meets quarterly to review technical issues with the program. And that process has basically been initiated. It was agreed to. And that kind of dovetails with the recommendations that came out of the NOAA 2015 passage report to produce a more fleshed out document. So those two things align, and that's all good, and that will be occurring. And I think the plan is to have that in place not for this migration year, but by the end of this calendar year. So that may not help us this year, but I think we'll certainly be able to coordinate, communicate, and think on our feet and do as best we can this year, which is what I wanted to talk about next, is what we're thinking.
Hey, Paul.
And by the way, I want to echo what everyone else has been saying about the quality of the information on FPAC and Fish Passage Center websites. It really is good information, mostly of concrete, but very good information, such as in forebays, temperature profiles at depth, comparisons with historical temperature averages in the system. Those charts that we're looking at right now that are on the Fish Passage Center website, I believe, that show we're actually tracking closer to 2015 temperatures in many areas of the system this year right now than tracking with the average temperature profile, which, of course, is the first early warning sign that we have. But we coordinate very well with our FPAC, FPOM, TNT representative. Many of you know Russ Keeper. We talk all of the time and are very coordinated, and I think that's one of the issues here, that many of the people on this call may not be that connected to that information. I mean, we have a representative that's, you know, three doors down from my office, and it's very easy for me to get and stay connected with the information that's coming out of those work groups. But maybe to others that don't have that advantage, this might seem like a process where those folks who are involved and engaged in that downstream river management stuff just talk to themselves, and that's one thing I thought we were going to talk about today, how to have better coordination between those folks and the rest of us folks, but let's just leave that parked for a minute. What I know that is planned for this coming year is continued or maybe better withdrawal at depth of cold water at Lower Granite Dam into the adult ladder, as well as into the forebay area of Lower Granite Dam, where fish come through the ladder into Lower Granite Forebay Pool, so that they don't hit a temperature block there after we've cooled the fish ladder water, so to speak. the temperature profile at Lower Granite is very good. Dworshak water releases stay pretty cold at depth and through that granite forebay. And I think there's a 4 or 5 or 6 degree temperature advantage of pumping water from 20 feet down up into the fish ladder and letting some of it go also in that forebay. And again, Rock, correct me if I'm mistaken, but the plan for this coming year is to do that at Granite. And also at Little Goose, I believe there is interest in a plan to do the same thing, even though the temperature profile difference at depth isn't quite as pronounced and advantageous as it is at Granite, because that cold water mixes once it goes through Granite, and as it goes through Little Goose Pool, it's not quite as stratified when it hits Little Goose Concrete. And really, by Lower Monumental and further downstream, I think all of the advantages of releasing cold water from Dworshak basically disappear. So, Rock, is that about right?
I think I got to correct everything you said. No, Paul, you got it correct. The one add-on I would say is that at Little Goose, I think we have developed the rationale that even though it's much smaller than Granite, it's a couple of 1 to 2 degrees, we're moving forward. We're trying to get an emergency contract in place by probably the end of June for early July, that if temperature should get to inconsistent in the ladders more than a degree or 2 degrees, that we would be able to implement an emergency pump system. But the long term is, I think we've got it lined up in the long term to put in a more permanent system at Little Goose.
Yeah. So thanks for that, Rock. So we're proceeding. We're keeping our eyes open. We'll stay very connected with the information that comes through the river management processes, the FPACs, et cetera. And we'll be ready to go at a moment's notice. This is a bit of an effort, obviously. We're not right next door to Lower Granite Dam, so I think we worked for a full month last year to do this, getting started a little bit after the curve with respect to, I think, how the region looks at what we did last year. We didn't start until the 13th of July with Trappan Hall, and, of course, we saw the peak temperature regime occur just right after the 4th or 5th of July, as I recall. So we'll be looking to amend that just a bit to try and be on the front end of any high water or temperature spikes and not deal with what we dealt with last year in terms of being maybe a week or so late. NOAA's report to the council that I mentioned earlier mentioned that, you know, implement earlier is what we heard, and certainly we're going to be on our toes and ready to do that. One of the things we encountered last year were Upper Columbia fish as far upstream, sockeye as far upstream as Lower Granite Dam. About 16 of the 50 or so sockeye that we did trap successfully at Lower Granite Dam weren't Snake River sockeye. We're concerned as we move downstream that we might see more of that, but we don't know. But that certainly won't deter us. We have the ability to identify those fish easily and not incorporate them into Snake River broodstock. So I think we'll be okay there. But Lynn, I don't know if you want anything else. That's about the summary from last year and, you know, how it's lining up for this year, and I think we're going to be ready. And I wish we could do something about the 80 to 90% that we don't have any influence over protecting downstream. And in that regard, we're kind of similar to the Okanagan and Wenatchee part of the equation here. That's a big problem. But that's it, unless you have questions for me.
Go ahead, Rob.
Well, this brought up just a thought here in thinking, trying to move things quickly. And, Paul, I don't know the answer to this, but it seems like we have certainly the identifying the problem, then you have the coordination loop in getting to a decision. But then I just want to make sure that regulatory is also thought of. In other words, there's regulatory mechanisms that you need to address before you can move on some of these actions. And just making sure those three areas are all covered is probably
important. Yeah. So in regard to that, very good question. I bet our representative, Russ Kiefer, was on the phone with Richie Graves or some other NOAA representative every day last year, authorizing a new twist or action for us to implement. NOAA was super responsive, and they turned around permission slips on a moment's notice. It was very accommodating, and from what we saw last year, Rock and everyone else, I don't expect that we're going to have any trouble in that area. But good point. But we're on that, too.
Okay. Paul, thanks. And I do want to just touch on, you know, you said you'd hopefully talk today about increasing or improving communication between, you know, the FPAC type group and others. And I do want to get to that. I think that's part of what we're doing today. So I think this is good just to kind of understand where you're coming from and what you're thinking and what points that you want to make related to all this. Just kind of clip through and hear what people have to say, and then we'll kind of come together and talk about issues that make most sense at that point.
Sure. One other add-on. You know, we've got great temperature information at Concrete, but as we move upstream into the Salmon River, I think there's only one recording station that has temperature information, maybe at Whitebird or something like that. And the other temperature information that we have comes from one of our biologists putting a thermometer in the stream or from our sawtooth hatchery temperature monitoring gauge way up into the system. And maybe one of the other things for the parking lot would be to talk about coordinating away from the concrete all of this information as well. Where does it come from? Who has it? It important that, you know, that's another item for the parking lot for later.
It is, and there's been, you know, before Jim Ruff left, he did some work with trying to coordinate some temperature profiling in the reservoirs, and we need to follow up on that. And there's a lot of work, a lot of temperature work going on in a lot of places, and I do, personally, I just feel a need to, there's going to be some coordination needs on the end of that. So, well, thanks. And let's, can we move to Jeff Korth to talk about Okanagan, Sockeye, and what you're thinking along those same lines?
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Good. So I'm with WDFW, and we have both the, as Paul said, the Okanagan, which I'm mostly going to talk about, stock, and there's also the Lake Wenatchee stock. Again, we lost probably 40 to 50% of the run in the Lower Columbia between before they ever got over McNary. That the saving grace there was that the run was so large to begin with. I think it was estimated at 500,000 fish at the mall, and that. Both the Okanagan and the Lake Wenatchee runs were phenomenal. At least they started out that way. We did have bottlenecks for both of the runs once they got to the Upper Columbia, or what we refer to as the Upper Columbia for anadromy purposes. The Lake Wenatchee, I'll just mention, didn't suffer that much greater loss. But they were delayed because the Wenatchee River itself was so warm and they wouldn't enter in, so they milled around in the Rock Island pool for quite a while. But eventually it cooled down enough and they shot up with all due speed, and still plenty of fish for escapement purposes, plus a fishery made it to Lake Wenatchee. Little anecdotal information, we ended up having to shut that fishery down even though there were plenty of sockeye, because we had spring chinook, among which there were wild Wenatchee spring chinook, which are listed as endangered, ducking into Lake Wenatchee, fish that would have gone up into the Chihuahua or Nason, ducking into Lake Wenatchee in great enough numbers that our encounter rates were going to exceed what the permit for the fishery allowed. So we had ran into other problems, again, climate-related, but not necessarily because of the numbers of sockeye. The Okanagan group of fish, despite the losses down at the lower river, we still ended up with almost 200,000 over Wells Dam. The bottleneck for those fish is, of course, the water temperatures in the Okanagan River and Lake Osuyus, lower Lake Osuyus to be specific. When it was all said and done, you know, those fish milled around in the Wells pool. Occasionally, even when the temperatures would drop a degree or so, those fish would make a run for it, and typically they all died in the Okanagan before they ever made it to Osuyus. The ones that did make it up to Osuyus mostly died in the south end there. All said and done, at the end of the day, only 12,000 fish actually made escapement up into the Okanagan River and Skaha. So it's pretty devastating here. I have been participating in a group previous to this. It's an international group of managers and regulators. So from Canada, it includes Department of Fisheries and Oceans and the Tribal Okanagan National Alliance, co-managers Yakima and the Colville Tribes, NOAA, representing all the lower river tribes, Creekfit participates, and DFW for the state. The group was originally put together to address necessary escapements into Canada, some ground truthing there. There's some new information out, and Canada has made quite a few improvements to the habitat, particularly spawning habitat up there, rearing habitat to some extent too, and to start talking about how we're going to split up the harvest of this stock that's international in its scope. After last year, the notion of trucking fish actually started with one of the Creekfit members, Jeff Fryer, and it quickly became a topic for our escapement harvest group. We haven't gotten extremely far along with it, I wouldn't say. We've been looking into things like the costs and where we would get the trucks and so forth. We're mostly talking about trucking fish from the Wells pool, from Wells Dam, that's where we're going to trap them, and take them up to Osuyus in Canada at the north end. But that part of the lake, for those unfamiliar, is much deeper, much colder, or at least it's cooler, I should say. There's quite often a pinch between O2 and temperature. The good news for this year, back off the trucking topic for just a second again, is that the reservoirs up in Canada are fairly full. They're spilling above normal, I think, right even as we speak. They were, at least. Lake Okanagan has a capacity, like Dorshak, I suppose, to spill some cooler water down this way. The hope is that they'll retain enough of that water, the temperature will stay cold enough that we can overcome, get some cooler water down through the south half of the Suits and into the Okanagan River by in July, in time for the steel or the sockeye when they start to arrive. But we wanted to have this some sort of a trucking plan in place. Believe it or not, the most difficult hurdle that we've encountered is actually trucking fish across the border. Evidently, it's okay if fish swim in on their own, but if they're in a truck, it's not acceptable at this point. It's a problem on the Canadian side, so my Canadian counterparts are working on that. But essentially what we're hearing right now is that plan away, but probably it'd be very difficult to get something to happen this year. Doesn't mean we shouldn't have a plan in place, of course, because you know, the way things are going, we're likely to encounter this much more often in the future than we have in the past.
Right. So it sounds like you're taking some action to try to increase coordination in your area. Ready.
Yeah, we already, the flow thing has been, there's another group of people, managers that work on the flow, and if the water's available, that's all pretty well coordinated. It's the trucking thing that pertains to the fish health aspects here that we're trying to pull off.
Thanks, Jeff. Appreciate that. Any questions for Jeff right now? Okay. So, Michelle, you're still on?
Yeah.
Could you give a thumbnail sketch of what you do there at the Fish Passage Center, what data you provide, and how you support the passage endeavors?
Yeah, so the Fish Passage Center was been around for a very long time and established by the Power Planning Council to provide technical support and data to the region relative to fish passage. So we've been doing this since 1983, long time. Relative to this particular question, everything on the fish path, this is intended to be transparent and available to the public. That's everyone. So what you'll find on the Fish Passage Center page is water temperature data, the forebase, the tail races. There will also be some scroll case temperatures where it is available. We have, this has always been on the Fish Passage Center website. I just want to make clear that Paul Klein and others discussed some new presentations of water temperature that we have up there now that's designed to be easier and more helpful to the managers. But water temperature data, both, you know, the historical water temperature and the actual, actual time temperature has always been on the Fish Passage Center website. Now we have arranged it so that you can actually see over the past 10 years for each of the projects, the forebay temperatures, the present year, last year, the 10-year average, and then there's great outlines that are each year, so you can get an idea of how close or far apart those temperatures are. It also displays the 68-degree reference temperature that first appeared in the 1995 biological opinion and is based on literature and research relative to at what point adult fish start reacting to water temperatures. And those reactions are the first reaction is delayed migration, right? So they start moving slower and holding up in different places, and then it evolves to, you know, to stress and disease and finally death. So that is up on the Fish Passage Center website. We're working with the Corps of Engineers right now. We've got most progress with the Walla Walla District, and we are also going to be showing on that website ladder water temperatures. There's several monitors in each of the ladders, and we'll be displaying both of those for all of the monitor temperature plus the differential between different monitors, because the research and data is indicating that the fishways are, particularly problematic, and that as little as a 1 degree temperature differential can cause fish to act differently, fall back, go downstream in the ladder, that kind of thing. So, those things are available to all of you on the FPC website. In addition, the adult counts are there. This year, last year, and the 10-year average, so you can look at that at the same time. We also have all of the juvenile passage data that is collected in the smolt monitoring program, and then all of the historical data. Now, Dave Statler, a few of you mentioned lamprey. There is lamprey data also on the Fish Passage Center website, so including fish condition, mortalities, and numbers. So you can also refer to that. The other thing that's available, and I think maybe most of you may already be on this, but the Fish Passage Center does a weekly report that we send out every Friday in which we kind of summarize what's happened, where we've gotten reports of fish kills, it could be anything, any highlighted, anything that happens that week. So if you're not getting that report, all you have to do is send an email to Paul LeBaron here at the Fish Passage Center and tell him you want to start receiving that weekly report. And that way you'll know what's happening in that particular week, if anything happened.
Tell Paul to get ready.
Lynn,
yeah.
Click on Impact down at the bottom, that link down at the bottom of the website.
On the other
side? Not where you are, the bottom border of the screen.
Oh, okay.
Click on FPAC.
Okay.
And then you're close to it. Click on...
the report?
It's in the bottom block, the daily average four-bay water temperature graphs. Up a couple right there.
Okay.
And then click on... scroll down a little bit, and you should see Bonneville. Just
click
submit form.
The dam you want.
Right.
Okay.
So what I was talking about in terms of how the temperatures are tracking, I don't know if you can see that or not, with the dark line being the average, the red line being 2015, and blue being the current year.
Okay. Great. Yeah, that's helpful.
Really good information at different dams.
Yep. Okay. Well, thanks, Michelle. Appreciate that.
Well, I just...
Pardon?
I just want to say one other thing. So, you know, this temperature data has always been up here. This is a presentation, a design that we did to make it easier for the public at large and everybody else to kind of check in on what the water temperature is at each of the projects. But it's always been there. So one other thing about the Fish Passage Center website, you know, there's a lot of stuff up here. If you need to, if you need help finding what you want, just give us a call and somebody will walk you through the whole site.
That's great. Thank you. Helpful. Yep, it's a good website. All right, well, I want to spend the next 25 minutes or so just checking in with other folks that are on the phone. I think Teresa Scott wanted to say a few things. She's a sort of flow emergency temperature coordinator person in WDFW. Teresa, sorry, I don't know what, I can't remember what what your work is titled. And I want to hear from Matt Boyer, Montana Fish Wildlife Parks, for more resident fish and main stem. I know, Matt, they do a lot in Montana, and they had to deal with these extreme temperatures last year as well. So actually, just start with Matt, and then we can go to Teresa and anyone else, Cryptic, EPA. Matt, are you still on?
I am, Lynn. Yeah, thanks. Can everybody hear me?
Yes.
Okay. All right, so Montana takes two general approaches to mitigate resident fish mortality in drought years, the first being through angling regulations and public outreach, and just recently start to get anglers in the mindset to prepare for another drought year. The department put out press releases and also some information for anglers on proper catch and release and fish handling techniques to help improve survival. The department on an annual basis also addresses the issue through angling restrictions and closures on streams and rivers. And we've been talking about, you know, environmental triggers or thresholds. And we've set this at when water temps reach 73 Fahrenheit or 23 C for three consecutive days, or when flows reach a minimum threshold. And all this is done through a process that's been established through Montana's Fish and Wildlife Commission. And, you know, there's obviously lag time between when these stream temperatures are taken in action. But for a bureaucratic process, it's pretty streamlined and responsive to changes in localized conditions. So once these closures are in place, then there's an established threshold for removing them. And this is set at 3 days below 70 Fahrenheit or 21 C. And, you know, perhaps surprisingly, these closures are actually they're well received by the public, including the guides and the outfitters. Who feel like they're able to do what's, you know, kind of in their power to help. And the department also has a website with an interactive map with real-time information to keep the public informed of, you know, the local angling regs. The second kind of general approach is through managing in-stream flows through reservoir management and also making calls on water right users that are junior to Montana's water rights for maintaining minimum in-stream flows. And within Fish, Wildlife, and Parks, there's a Habitat Bureau, and their responsibilities for monitoring these flows and sending notification letters to some of the irrigators. You know, because of the sensitivity around restricting water diversions to irrigators, Fish, Wildlife, and Parks, we don't take this action until everything else has been done to mitigate fishery impacts, you know, through changes in angling regs and water body closures. So that's a quick overview of what's done for resident fish here in Montana. And if there are any questions, I'd be happy to address them.
Do you have any questions? Thanks, Matt. That was good. And it seems like it's pretty straightforward, and you have general agreement on what the triggers are and what the actions are and the thresholds.
Yeah.
And, wow, calling junior water right owners, that's great.
Yeah, and Montana's fortunate to have those established water rights for minimum in-stream flows. And like I said before, you know, we don't invoke that until we feel like we've done everything else in our power.
Okay, that's helpful. Thank you. Teresa, do you want to tell us what your role is at WDFW, a statewide level?
Well, if I ever figure it out, I will tell you. my nominal title at the moment is Water Resource Policy Coordinator. And what that means is when we have low flows, high water temperatures, that sort of thing, water shortages, that I do coordination on information regarding drought, right? So we don't have a declared drought in Washington right now, but we have conditions right now that our WDFW thinks require our attention regardless of whether the state calls it a drought. So one of the things that I'm involved in is with other state agencies on that decision to declare a drought and then the aftermath of that decision. So that's the kind of one of the worlds that is completely separate from river management, but is very involved in water temperature data collection, response, and that sort of thing. So that's one piece. Another piece is just what Matt was talking about. We don't have a plan and criteria as well set out as Montana does. We're working on that, though, having had the wake-up call last year of needing to know what our ranges are and our trigger points are. And they're different for every stream, depending on what fish we're concerned with. So that's, you know, just one complication. It's not all about 68 degrees Fahrenheit. It's a lot of different triggers we would have. And then so we have the Department of Ecology in Washington who manages in-stream flow rules. And in 2015, there were several basins with curtailments of junior water users to make sure that water was left in-stream for fish. So that's a function of the Department of Ecology. We here at WDFW also participate with partners who have reservoirs and do reservoir management in helping to make decisions about what the fish flows need to be, how we make sure we have enough reservoir water to ensure that we have sufficient flows in the fall, and other questions like that. We have fishing regulations, as Matt suggested and as Jeff was talking about, and we can regulate, make fishing closures and restrictions based on the water temperature if we have the sufficient data on which to base those decisions. So the sufficient data part is obviously a bit of an issue. And we issue hydraulic project approvals, which are which are permits that protect fish habitat when people are doing water that affects stream beds or flows. And again, we look at regulating those or restricting those when the temperatures are really high and fish are stressed. On the other hand, if flows are really low, that's when we want people doing those projects. So it's just kind of watching what the conditions are during the period when people would want to do that. So those are the kind of things we do. And my role has been to kind of be the conduit that people can talk to me and find out what to do with the information they've got or where to find the information. So first thing I want to do is thank the Fish Passage Center for the temperature data that they provide, because it saves me from having to put that context together. What have the averages been, and, you know, what is that all about? I am doing that for other streams in Washington, and there are a number of gauges, but not as many as you would want. A number of gauges that have water temperature on them, both USGS gauges and ecology gauges, but there are never enough when you want to try and protect fish. So I've been a traffic cop in terms of connecting people with other people that have the information, or they want to respond and they don't know who to talk to about responding, or, you know, that kind of thing. So that's the service I've been providing.
Okay, excellent. Yeah, traffic cop, I can see that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you. Any questions for Teresa? All right. Those sound like, familiar tools in the toolbox for dealing with this at a statewide level and tributary level. CRPFIC, I know there's somebody from CRPFIC.
Diane
Barton. Yeah, I don't know if you want to say anything.
Hi, I'm sorry, I was on mute.
Okay.
I think some of the previous speakers have spoken to the fact that CRPFIC staff has been engaged on the fish passage and haulage questions. You know, I guess some of the concerns that I just wanted to share is the response of or the use of cold water refuges. I know that EPA is working on that. And then, you know, I've heard several speakers talk about the losses below McNary and, you know, the need for some response items there. So I think that's all for now.
Okay. Thanks, Anne. I just want to note that Laura Gephardt sent me a one-page. This is probably information that exists in a number of places, probably even on the Fish Passage Center website, but it's water temperature passing Bonneville Dam from April through August. Uses data from 1940 through 2016. So it's a one-pager on historic data, water temperature.
Yeah, and we have that graphed up on our website now, too.
Yep, I know it's new, so thank you for that. How about Mary Lou? Anything that you want to add from EPA's perspective?
Yeah, so I guess there's just a couple things I want to add, and that is, I think this is a really great conversation, and I really appreciate Lynn and the council for bringing people together, and I think that temperature is a really critical issue. EPA has been trying to deal with it for a long time. Folks might remember we started a TMDL back in the 90s that we never totally finished. And so I think this is a really important conversation, and I think in addition to thinking about emergency measures, and, you know, I know this isn't the forum to do it, I think we also need to think about, well, what are the things that we can do to try and, you know, address temperatures? And, I just want to mention that from EPA's perspective, we talk about the 68-degree number, and so for water quality standards for the Columbia, we are very sophisticated and we use centigrade instead of Fahrenheit. So we
what's that?
At the EPA, we are so sophisticated. So we we use 20 degrees C. But I just want to say, you know, in 20 degrees C and, you know, 68 F are the same thing. But that's sort of an upper boundary, guys. You know, that's like the limit. And so if we start talking about emergency measures, I think we talk lower. We look at like setting it a lower number so that we don't use 68 or 20 as our trigger point. We go lower because I think it's really important because we don't. I mean, even though the numbers, might probably can go over 68 or 20, we don't want them to, and we want to see if we can try and take action below those numbers. And then the other thing I would add is I think I really agreed with the conversations about having leadership on this issue because there are a lot of forums right now where there's conversations. Rock and I are on the Columbia River Federal Caucus. We've been talking about temperature now for about 2 years. It's one of our priority topics. We just had a really good conversation with NOAA. And so a lot of folks worked hard on, which was their, they have their draft that I know folks probably in this group reviewed their draft, sockeye salmon passage. And a lot of people have given comments to NOAA about how we try and address that. So all that stuff, we sort of need to figure out how that stuff comes together because there is a lot of stuff happening in different forums and getting some leadership and sort of channeling all the really, like Lynn said, there's a lot of smart people channeling all that really good thinking and getting it happening in one place or one or two places instead of five or six places, I think is a way we can actually get some progress and get some actions, some coordinated actions mm-hmm. together. Mm-hmm. So I think, and then EPA has some ideas, but I won't get into those ideas. I think the ideas of, relate to how we make some different decisions in the river, and I think those are some of those operation issues that we can talk about in other forums and other situations.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And John Palmer, if you're still there, I just wanted to give you a chance if you wanted to add anything to that.
Not a lot to add to that, Mary Lou. I think you covered it. Bigger picture, we're looking at ways to where we can cool the river, especially earlier in the year now, since that's been looking like a problem. And, of course, we're doing the Cold Water Refugia report over the next several years. To protect and restore and try to evaluate how important it is in the Columbia in particular.
Good. Thank you, Mary Lou and John. Any questions for those two, EPA? All right. I'd be remiss if we didn't hear a little bit more about thoughts about sturgeon.
How about USGS?
Yeah, I'll get to them. Dan Rodding or Tom Reen? Anything you want to add about sturgeon?
This is Tom, Lynn. I'm not sure what you are thinking I can add, but, we recognize that last year was a relatively serious problem for sturgeon, particularly in John Day and McNary Reservoirs. We saw substantial numbers of sturgeon die, and the oversized or broodstock-sized sturgeon represented that we actually saw were nearly 2% of the known broodstock populations. And again, you pointed out that those fish we saw were only those that managed to float up and appear on shore and were actually found by somebody. So we don't know the magnitude of the problem, as well as we don't know exact cause of the death, although it's clearly related to high temperatures, and there's a fair amount of speculation about the actual causes of death, including that we had these large sockeye die-offs and that sturgeon were consuming a lot of sockeye, and that just that event of their own, they by gorging on those sockeye, they may have caused a metabolic burden that further stressed them. So the problem when we were sampling was a couple of fold. So we did carcass surveys throughout the Willamette River and the Columbia River using crews that were to some extent kicked off the water because we shut down sampling. And so those crews were following shorelines and looking for carcasses of both salmon and sturgeon, et cetera, as they did that. But once we've enumerated those, another obvious need for information would be take it, like you described, Lynn, taking a tissue sample or taking a whole fish in ascertaining its cause of death. And the problem we ran into, and I think you're talking about this in next steps, was that once you have those fish, actually once the fish are dead, they are of less use to at least ODFW's pathology labs, because gathering information what the cause of death is more difficult at that stage. And actually they were seeking sort of near dead or moribund fish that they could examine. And just getting those to our labs is a challenge, because we're doing sampling at John Day up by Umatilla, and our lab is in Corvallis. So to rush those things downstream is difficult. So having some processes in place that allow us to both coordinate sampling across various entities in Oregon and Washington, it was both our state agencies, Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife, Oregon Fish and Wildlife, as well as our state enforcement agencies were conducting those surveys. But a larger presence might be needed on the river. And then, like you said, Olaf gathered information on sturgeon and assembled that. But that was all on an ad hoc basis. So I think one of the things that outside of the concrete has been described is that, you know, these reservoir reaches are also experiencing high temperatures, and both how we sample those and how we can address those high temperatures are a primary concern for resident fish species. I don't know if Dan wants to add anything.
Sure, Tom. Great summary. I guess what I'd remind folks is that we've talked about Okanagan and Snake River solutions largely with transport or trap and haul. Remember that these sturgeon are landlocked populations, and we don't have much fish passage at dams. So the solutions that we've proposed for those aren't really going to work for resident fish that live in those reservoirs. There were comments about from EPA about water quality standards in the Columbia Basin and those types of things. I think those are going to be likely the long-term solutions to dealing with fish that are landlocked.
Different set of issues and a lot the same. So thanks for the report. So I think that's important to keep the sturgeon in mind, and it makes me think back to hearing Sarah talk about the uniquely positioned like fish ambulances they had around the Klamath Basin. And correct me if I'm wrong, but these were almost like medic units that were equipped with sampling equipment and all the things they need for sort of a lab focus. Interesting thought, anyway, about applying that concept to the Columbia Basin, which takes me to USGS. They do have a facility at Cook Lab that potentially could help with that kind of thing, but I want to hear from USGS folks up in Seattle who are calling in, and just your thoughts in general, listening to the conversation, and anyway, go ahead if you're on and are willing to say a few words.
Well, this is Jim Winton in Seattle. I found this interesting. One of the things that the USGS did do last year, they had a rapid response to put some hydrograph in some locations that aren't currently provided with strain gauges. So they have, I think, some gauging and some temperature data from some parts of the system. But on a larger scale, one of the things that was proposed but not really funded was to take some of the fish health work and coordinate that through the various fish health centers. There are plenty of fish health centers in the Columbia Basin maintained by the states and certainly the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. And to overlay some of the hydrograph temperature data with the locations of some of the fish kills, as well as their causes, which are primarily columnaris disease, as they were in the Klamath and the Rogue. And then overlay that with some of the climate change models to really get an idea about how often we're going to expect to see this, and if so, when. For example, in the Klamath, the large fish kill in 2002 occurred when the stream gauges said that was about the lowest flow in the last 50 years. So the question is, with the climate models, is that going to happen every 50 years or every 10 years or every 5 years? And I think some of the climate models, while not really precise, would begin to give us some kind of ability to anticipate some of these events and maybe add a little bit of urgency to the need to have in-stream flow or temperature triggers that really help to aggressively mitigate or manage those conditions where possible. Now, there's going to be a lot of systems that those triggers or those conditions or those options are not going to be present, and that's going to be a problem. But I think in the Columbia Basin, and I'm talking to people who know more about this than I do, that there are going to have to be some trade-offs, but I think a better look at the potential frequency or severity of these kinds of conditions might be useful for that discussion.
Okay, thank you. Any additional thoughts?
I was just struck by something that Tom Rein said. This is Tony Grover. A long trip to take the fish to the lab in Corvallis. And then Lynn mentioned one thing they do in the Klamath is they pre-position equipment. And it's almost flipping the topic and having the essence, the required elements of a lab pre-positioned in various places around the basin. And so you could essentially bring the lab to the fish as opposed to bringing the fish to the lab every time. So if there's a fish kill or a few sturgeon bodies or something like that, you can shorten up and reduce the labor involved if equipment was pre-positioned. And at the risk of alarming some people, I hope I don't, but that's one thing that the state of Washington learned through responding to hazardous material spills over the years is all over the state there's pre-positioned equipment in trailers that when an event occurs, people know that they can just get up from their offices, drive to a location, hook up the trailer, and go to the event site with all the gear and equipment and tools that they need to do an accurate assessment in a very short period of time. So just a thought.
Yeah.
Kendra, this is Andy Goodwin. I'm the Fish Health Program Manager for the Fish and Wildlife Service. I work out of Portland. Mark Bagovitz is our official representative on this group, but he kind of let me gate crash today.
Okay.
We do indeed have a fully functional fish health laboratory in Willard, Washington. So that's, in the gorge, not too far from Bonneville. So in that part of the river, we have expertise nearby. And working out of that fish health center is Ken Lujan, who's got a major responsibility in the National Wild Fish Health Survey. And as part of his work, he does a lot of sampling and testing of fish up and down the Columbia River. So I was hoping he was going to be able to join us on this call today, too, because, he was involved a lot last summer with the dams and with sick fish from up and down the river. And I think that that laboratory and Ken probably can be a real useful resource to this group, and we're happy to help when we can.
Excellent. Thanks. Willard. Yeah. All right. Excellent.
That's good information.
Yeah. Yeah, that is.
Yeah, this is Dan. I think Ken was the one that identified the sockeye that were dying from columnaris last summer.
Yep.
Oh, okay.
The Drano Lake.
Yeah, there were some. The Drano, and there were some photos from there too. We saw he may have been taking some of the photos as well.
Yeah.
Mary Lou.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask. The gentleman from USGS, I thought he said that there was a general understanding that most of the fish kills were from columnaris. Is that what everybody is? I was just wondering if that was a general understanding with everybody, or if that's just something that USGS is saying, because I had not heard that yet.
Good question. I don't know. Paul, Dan, Tom, Dave, Settler?
folks at CRPSA. This is Dan. When I talked with the Willard Lab, they had identified the sockeye were infected with columnaris that they sampled. I'm not sure if, you know, they didn't sample a lot of fish, and I'm not sure how to extrapolate that, but definitely columnaris was identified.
Okay.
And this is Jim Wenton. I didn't mean to give the impression that it was solely a columnaris fish kill. There are plenty of pathogens
primarily
in the lumpia that operate at warm temperatures. That just happened to be one of the most consistent findings.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Thanks for clarifying that.
Yeah,
I was trying to understand that.
Yeah, good question. Okay, I guess I would just open it up to anyone else who has any thoughts kind of before we move into the next phase, which I hope Jennifer's going to help with a little bit. any more on what you're doing or what you're thinking or thoughts on coordination actions for the summer or in the future? Are there any other folks on the phone that want to speak up? Bob?
Well, I mean, I think our tribes are as involved as possible. Yeah, Bob Austin, Upper Spencer Tribes. I know the folks working on sockeye habitat, the Shoshone Bannocks are very interested in this topic, and I'm glad to hear that everyone is indeed working together, talking about the issues, trying to be more anticipatory in terms of actions that can be taken. And on the note about resident fish, it's going to be really tough to do much there other than, you know, being able to, you know, figure out how to, you know, keep those temperatures low throughout the system, because they're pretty much a captive population, so there's not a lot to do, but there may be some things that we could think about that could make conditions better all through the season. So
yeah,
more work to
okay.
be done there.
Yeah. Okay. Anyone else in the room? Anyone else on the phone? Okay. Well, thanks. That was a lot of good information. Now, what do we do with it? That's the question. What I had is just the remaining time, and it's about 20 minutes now, really. I had, you know, some questions on, you know, what more do we need? What do we need? Environmental data? You know, who houses it? These were just thoughts that came into my head. How do we deal with potential conditions similar to last year this summer? So far, my understanding is it's not looking great right now going into the summer. What about resource equipment sharing? Do people want to continue talking about how we improve or increase coordination between some of the existing groups that are working on like dam passage and data collection with a broader audience? Those are the kind of things I think we should be considering right now in this group, is like, where do people want to go from here? And Jennifer, do you have any particular thoughts or starting points given your amazing note taking?
Well, so far I think my notes are all over the board. So we heard that there are many forums for discussion, but no leadership, and that may be an opportunity. And we also heard that maybe we should just try and make existing information more available, but don't try and create something new. So we're all over the map, and I think there's a lot of opportunity here if people are interested in taking it. So I would just turn it over for open discussion and see what people are thinking at this point.
Yeah, that sounds great.
So,
Tom
Iverson, on the communication front, you've lost Jim Ruff, who used to attend a lot of these FCRPS meetings. It might be good for council staff to have a person at the TMT meeting each week and monitor some of these other forums. And in preparing a monthly report through the summer, would force that staffer to sort of track the issues in the various forums as to what's happening with sturgeon, with sockeye, with fish passage operations, and all that, water temperatures. But that might be a good central communication device that sort of forces a monthly report anyways and tracks the various forums.
Okay.
Because there's so much silence, I'm Tony
break it
here again. I've talked to a few people that have been attending an estuary conference down in Astoria this week and Ocean and Estuary Conference. And I would just caution people that while we're in a bad situation inland this year, it's maybe not as bad as last year, and so the pressure feels like it's coming off. But on the flip side, we're hearing that ocean conditions are not good. The runs are declining. So I would encourage people to, if you're interested in building some sort of a communication coordination network, and I'm certainly not rejecting Tom Iverson's suggestion, the council works best when it has the broad, solid support of the region when it's moving. So that's something we can talk further about. But I think we need to not lock ourselves into just, oh, my gosh, we're going to have 2015 again and again, because the problem could show up differently in different years. It's a really big system. Some of you have pointed that out. And it's a system that actually has a huge footprint in the ocean as well. And we have a lot of different ESA-listed and non-ESA-listed species. So whatever system is created, and I strongly encourage you fish managers to work with us and tell us what we can do to help you build such a system, but to make sure it's flexible enough to handle these changing conditions. The 2015 was a surprise. I don't think anybody in the basin really anticipated what happened. And I expect that climate change is throwing some more surprises at us in the next few years. So let's not lock into just trying to prepare for 2015 again.
That's a good point. And Jennifer made this point several times, is that we really need to maintain and think about the connections between downriver passage even, just passage alone and upriver implications. So we need to keep those connections. It's not just about at-dam passage. It's about how it affects the whole system. And, yeah, I've heard that too. Ocean conditions are tanking.
Mm-hmm.
So that means ever more important to get the fish that we have coming back to where they need to be.
Yep.
Yeah, Lynn. Yeah, this is Eric Rowell, coordinator for ISTV and IRCRP. Just kind of add to what Tony was saying, you know, it's fresh on my mind, probably on Tom's too, who attended that estuary conference, and I think most of you maybe heard Bill Peterson presentation on ocean conditions and smaller fish coming back. But there is, you know, similar to what's done in the Klamath, we do have that kind of checklist for the ocean that's created by NOAA, and it seems like that could maybe part of the trigger that also informs thinking about in river, you know, the type of fish that are coming back, smaller body, maybe their fecundity is worse, maybe they have less lipids to get them up the system. How is that going to affect, you know, river operations? So how do you use that information to inform?
Oh, that's a really good point.
And as you were saying, it's not looking great in terms of the fish coming back.
Right. So the reports are that we're going to have smaller fish, not as many and smaller. Maybe not a strong, able body.
It's a lot. You know, it's hard with so much uncertainty.
Yeah.
It's hard for people to be firm on it, but it's definitely a worry.
Yeah. Interesting. All right. NOAA checklist. And we don't have anybody from NOAA on the phone. It's just unfortunate they were all unable to be here today. So, good point. Anyone else? Thoughts? Folks on the phone?
Well, maybe thoughts? I can have Bob off again. You know, the system is really complex, and we have, I don't know how many hatcheries yet all over the basin, and so some of these things like ocean conditions could drive when hatchery fish should be released or not, or maybe delayed or earlier. So there could be a lot of other, you know, elements of coordination that could flow into, you know, getting a better feeling for how the system is changing and how to best get that information back to others who need to be making decisions at certain times rather than, oh, gosh, we should have done this 2 weeks ago or a month ago. But, you know, it's kind of a learning experience. So, I mean, there are lots of parties that, like we said, aren't even here today, but they really need to be a part of this whole picture.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in the last year, it just occurs to me, we've had so many presentations by folks in the basin in front of the council, like on conditions and changes. I think that alone is like helps to increase coordination in the region. So I'd vote for, you know, sort of continuing those ongoing, you know, sort of focused reports to the council panels on conditions and adaptive management in particular.
So can I ask a question? Okay, so it's 3:20, and we've heard a lot of really good information, but I think we're still at a point, okay, what do we do with this, and how do we come up with some sort of plan? So you guys did a really great job of bringing people together, are you able to show some leadership in helping to coordinate folks to help come up with a plan? Because I think this was a real success in terms of, with the exception of Noah not being here, and we have to get them at the next one. But I think this was like a good sort of reference document assessment. And it seems like the next step, I mean, and there were some ideas that came out, but the next step is to sort of lay out, you know, start working on a plan. And there's some different components. I mean, like we've heard about the Willard facility, and there's some other ideas, but it just seems like that could be the framework for another conversation. And Tony's gone thumbs up for people who are on the phone, so maybe the council is willing to provide some facilitation leadership on this issue, which I think would be really great.
Well, thank you, Mary Lou. Tony here again. And I've talked this over with Member Anders, who is the head of our Fish and Wildlife Committee, and he's talked a little bit here. We are very supportive, but I'm not going to shock any of you by saying we're not interested in getting out in front of your headlights. We don't want to, as FDR once said, leadership is great as long as you don't turn the corner and get out of sight of the people you're leading. So we can only lead in ways that you all want us to lead. So one thing I feel confident enough to say is, shall we schedule the next meeting? And we're happy to do that. We're happy to pull that together. Lynn is our point person on these issues, so... Unless there's strong objection or someone else wants to step forward, we're willing to coordinate the next phone call.
So Tony, this is Dan. I've got a couple of thoughts. So first, I thought that we did lay out some plans for snake that we didn't have last year that we developed on the fly. Jeff talked about some planning that's going on in the Okanagan. So I'm feeling that we're much better off this year than we were last year. The FPAC discussion largely has been that there aren't any real silver bullets for decreasing temperatures between McNary and Bonneville Dam right now. And if we get those high temperatures, we're going to see a lot of that same mortality. If we get those high air temperatures, which will translate to water, high water temperatures, we're going to see a lot of that mortality. So when people talk about plans, what are we talking about? Are we talking about a plan to get back to normative temperatures in the entire Columbia Basin? Are we talking about a plan to save, to reduce mortalities for sockeye? Are we talking about a plan for sturgeon, which would be very different than sockeye? I just don't know where what people are thinking about those things, and those of a really large scale, really large scale planning is going to take a lot more people than are on this call and a lot more expertise. And I'll just leave that open for a comment.
Lynn, this is Michelle, and I wonder if I could just follow up a little bit on what Dan – first, I agree with everything that Dan said just now. You know, we go to all the FPAC meetings and track all this data. But I would just like to add one point to what Dan said, and that is that there is an about salmon and steelhead passage. There is a lot of research and analysis that's been done on salmon and steelhead passage. And my only kind of comment is at FPAC, pretty much the people that are involved in that forum, you know, they're paying a lot of attention to the research that's been done. But you have to look at what that research is saying about upstream fish passage. Certainly all of it identifies that fact that high water temperatures, and I agree with what Mary Lou said too, the 68, that's when the wheels fall off. Research has shown that, especially for sockeye, they can show adverse kind of reactions at a lot lower temperatures, depending on what stock it is and you know where they come from. I'm just saying there's a lot of information out there. As you try to plan for something, I'm just recommending that whoever's involved in this planning really get up to speed in what we already know about what affects upstream fish passage. Including temperature, but all of the other things that affect upstream fish passage also. So there's a lot of knowledge out there, and I think to have a successful plan, you have to start with really getting up to speed with the knowledge that's out there.
Yeah, that makes sense. Rob, you had comments?
Yeah, just a thought. I guess I operate in a pretty small world as it relates to more to the hydro, but I guess the first step in my mind would be trying to make sure, and what I thought of the coordination sharing, it's making sure the managers who may not be in the FPAC forums or the FPOM forums, when we start hitting these triggers, the state federal managers or tribal folks can get this information so they can start making informed decisions, whether it be hatchery decisions or harvest decisions or whatever it may be. I'm way outside my headlights at this point. But the point is making sure when we do see the risks start to increase, it's just understanding the scope of what can be done to solve it. I don't think this forum is going to be able to fix the white elephant that I just heard Dan, which I think we all understand, it's trying to minimize the danger. That's a huge first step all in itself. So, to me, that's where I kind of think this thing, just understanding the scope of what we can assist with, would be very helpful.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So that's when I let me see if I understand. So you're talking about really the communication outward from like FPAC into the management realm, so decisions can be made, people know what's going on.
Correct.
Yeah.
Maybe it's already occurring, but that seems to me to be making sure the hatchery managers know what's coming out.
Mm-hmm. Okay. The one thing I've thought about I've thought a lot about this, is, I mean, it might be helpful to start with, some lists, some inventory of resources or tools in the toolbox related to mainstem that are easy to do, less expensive to do, impossible to do, and maybe terribly expensive to do. I mean, all options on the table. That for tributary and mainstem.
Hmm.
Just throw them out there and see what we have and just start talking about it. I mean, it just might help sort of facilitate a broader conversation. What do y'all think? You, Tom, you were... You had a thought about that. Maybe Sarah, I don't know if you're still on the phone, but you've been through this. What are like some first steps you guys took to get sort of going or to get understanding that there's different planning scopes for different areas of the basin, but like Dan mentioned, but what sort of started a conversation to get you where you are?
Each entity kind of had to figure out what they could do and who was responsible where. That's kind of where we started. What could you do? And who's going to take charge where was a kind of a big step. So that way we weren't stepping on others' toes. It's like, okay, if you're going to take responsibility in this area, we'll leave that area to you. So define who's where, who's on first.
The geographical, the
yeah.
geography of it all. Yeah.
Right.
Okay.
The plumbing. And then, you know, what can you do in each of your areas? Figure out what could be done. And what's being done already? I mean, who's doing the water quality? Who's doing the temperature? You know, get it all on one page so everybody doesn't have to duplicate. You know, they could spend their money somewhere else if somebody's already doing something.
Okay, thanks.
I like that. The plumbing.
The plumbing.
Look at the plumbing and see if it's all connected up. And if it isn't, connect parts that aren't. And then figure out what you want to do.
Right. Okay. So 3:30. Jennifer, any final thoughts? Tony? We have an offer to have a follow-up call out there. What do people think?
Yeah, Lynn, my thought is, thanks, Pat, and that's first tribe. My thought is, you know, a follow-up meeting would be good, and based on, you know, what I think I heard, you know, the concept about, you know, action response readiness and all that kind of stuff that might be good going into that meeting to have a kind of a draft anyway of the tools in the toolbox kind of thing to have people discuss and deliberate. The other point I want to make is that we're talking about like an emergency response kind of approach here. Largely, we've been talking about temperature, and you know, the fact of the matter is that we've been teetering on the brink of temperature in the main stem kind of like all the time, like in the lower snake. And the reason we haven't tipped over that much is because of Dorshak and that cool water supply. That we fortunately have at our disposal. But even at that, it's pushing the limits. And so it's kind of, when you talk about tools in the toolbox, those are the kinds of things that we need to consider. That. And if you use Dorshak, for example, to respond to a specific, quote, crisis situation, that's going to impact the availability of Dorshak water to, as an example, to last the remaining of a hot season, to try to provide conditions that are more suitable to all the species at risk. Thank you.
Thank you. All right. I think, Jennifer, were you going to say something?
Actually, Lynn,
somebody?
It's Paul Klein.
Okay.
Would it do any good to tee up identifying, well, first of all, we learned a lot today about on FPAC and Fish Passage Center website.
Mm-hmm.
Really think there are still gaps that remain that would be useful information.
Welcome
to
Verizon Wireless.
Maybe tee that up for a follow-up meeting so that we could focus on what we don't know and what we think we need to still know.
Okay.
That's just a thought for direction for a follow-up meeting. And then one final that many people have talked about with respect to what goes on in these various forums downstream that talk about river operations and conditions. Real-time information would be great to have beyond just what gets posted on websites. There are TMT calls that occur all of the time where there are decisions made about implementing certain actions that we're really not privy to unless you sit on one of those committees. If there was a way to tap into that, it's probably a lot of work for someone to, after a call, you know, send out an email about what was talked about because notes don't come out immediately. But that would be useful as well because there are a lot of conversations that go on real time that we're not privy to at all unless you sit on one of those committees. So that's just another thought I have that would help us all.
Okay.
Paul, Tony here. I just have to believe in this day and age of where somebody can post what they had for breakfast 10 minutes after to 10,000 of their best friends. We should be able to get some quick highlights out of meetings very shortly after a meeting.
Tony, did Jim Roth participate in those forums?
Yes, but he wasn't a social media user. And as some of you may know, we have a vacancy and we're seeking to fill it. And it's quite possible that whoever we fill it with would reengage in many of those forums again.
Social media too.
Facebook. Yeah. So sounds like we have some things to do. I guess the question is, do we need to do this sooner rather than later, given the time of year it is? Is this something we want to, like, schedule 2 weeks from now, a month from now, or, you know, after August when all said done?
So this is Teresa Scott. I just want to make sure. I'm not sure we need to do that for this year, but I want to make sure that I'm contributing however I can possibly contribute to some of the really important stuff such as the Snake River Sockeye, you know, work that may need to be done this year. So I want to stay connected from that standpoint. I don't know that I think we can put together a huge huge system in that period of time. Ours took years.
Yeah, I complete Tony again. Therese, good to hear your voice. I knew if you were involved, things that would be enlightened. I agree. I think communication, fixing the plumbing is the first step. Hooking up the places where information resides and making it more broadly available and giving people time to think about what they might want out of a regional network of some sort, whatever that might look like. And there's no reason why these meetings couldn't turn into, if you missed the news everywhere else, we can give you an update on what we know about this year. That could be part of these calls. Just making sure people are hooked up and connected.
Okay.
Totally.
Well, I might, go ahead. Who was trying to speak on the phone?
That was Tariq.
Oh, okay. I might suggest that you just, at this point, reach out to me directly or by email, thoughts from the meeting or next steps, and let's go from there. I am willing, because I think this is the easier thing, is to, like, explore options for maybe coordination of, you know, equipment or processing lab stuff, or at least kind of inventory that aspect of things. So if we do have fish kale this year, we can sort of deal with that on a quicker, more efficient basis. I think that's easier than the other part. It feels like it.
And it's a good start.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Thanks. Any other thoughts? All right. Just email me or directly, or feel free to CC the group that was on this email today and just help up.
Thank you for organizing and doing so
thank
much
you all for coming.
Work. Yeah, did a lot of good work.
Yeah, thank you. Thank
Thanks
you all for contributing. For any last thoughts, Tom, you're... Okay, thank you all.
Thanks, Lynn.
Yeah, Jennifer?
Thank you, Lynn.
Thank you.